Welcome to this week's episode of Electric Podcast. I'm Fred Lambert, your host, and I'm joined by Seth Wintraub, who is still in Alaska. How are you doing, Seth?
Good.
Awesome.
Fun over here.
Yeah. All right. So, again, a lot of craziness to talk about this week, and we got a few questions in the YouTube channel. So, reading them now, I think it's all things that we plan to touch in the when we cover the article that we published this week. So everything should be good there. Starting with all the whistleblower stuff this week, it got a little crazy. First with, again, Martin Tripp. What happened this week with Martin Tripp, if you guys don't know, is the self-proclaimed Tesla whistleblower who used to work at Tesla Fremont. Sorry,
just, no, it was a Gigafactory.
Gigafactory. We're stuck on you for some reason. Even if I talk, I'm not sure why. But anyway, Gigafactory, like you said, what happened is this week he went on a sort of Twitter rant, basically posting all what he perceived as evidence of his previous claims that he made through other media outlets, sending him information. Then those media outlets sort of reprinted his claim like verbatim without much of any evidence. Now he sort of backed those evidence that was first released in the media. And that took the form of for his claim that Tesla installed punctured battery cells into Model 3 vehicles. He posted the actual VINs of the vehicle affected, allegedly affected, and an image of actually a bunch of images of battery modules that he said contained those punctured cells and how they were reworked, so a before and after of being reworked. Not much that we can discern from the actual images other than, yeah, it looks like there's been a bit of work on those battery modules. Then, well, what's, of course, a lot more worrying is the VINs that he posted, because now we shared all that on Electrek, and we asked people that have those cars, because those cars are in the hands of customers right now, if they had any issues with them and everything. About a dozen of Model 3 owners got back to us. None of them seem to have any type of problem with their battery pack. Two of them said that they couldn't get a full, on a full charge, didn't get 310 miles of range. But that's not exactly unusual, no matter the state of the battery cells inside your pack. So nothing too worrying right now. But of course, we recommend them to reach out to Tesla anyway. But Tesla responded to them the same way they responded to us, which is completely denying the claim that they're saying that there's no punctured cells inside those packs. So it's very much a he said, she said situation. Don't know if you agree with that, Seth?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the evidence would be in the packs. I mean, it would be easy to prove or disprove if the claims hold any legitimacy. Why would Tesla even do that? Like, why would Tesla put punctured cells into a car? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, especially since the cells cost like a cell itself, like it's a bunch of, is it even a few dollars? I mean, we know that there are thousands of cells as a pack. Pack is valued about like maybe $10,000. So it's a few dollars per cells, maybe at best. So why put the foot puncture one in there?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, you know, like as erratic as the press has made Elon sound over the last week, this guy sounds like 10 times more erratic, like actually going on Twitter and really, you know, putting out these VIN numbers, which, like, where did he even get the VIN numbers? I'm assuming, you know, he had access to them when he worked at Tesla and he took that with him, which is probably a crime. So I don't know. It's kind of a weird situation.
In the lawsuit that, because he filed a counter lawsuit against Tesla after Tesla initiated a first lawsuit against him for what they claim was like sabotage and stealing information and a bunch of stuff. In his own counter lawsuit, he explained how he managed to get those VINs, saying that he tracked the basically the batch of battery modules that he thought contained those punctured cells, which were then reworked. Then he followed all those battery modules to find out in which car, when I say follow, I mean follow through the Tesla's logistics system and not physically follow them, being installed inside cars. So apparently Tesla has the ability to follow single cells into a single pack, then a pack to a module into a pack, and then pack into a car, which is not impossible. It's a lot of logistics. And there's probably a way physically to do it. And now whether they actually punctured cells in there, that's a bigger question. And I sincerely doubt it. Because like I said, it's a season situation. So it's whether you trust Tesla more than you trust Martin Tripp. And like you said, he sounds very erratic on his Twitter, social media. That's what is interesting too, because his account, he deleted his account right after making those claims. So aside from the punctured cell, he also posted a bunch of stuff about the amount of scraps that Tesla was producing at Gigafactory 1. But again, it's not like, is it very unusual for a factory of that size that produces about 20 gigawatt hour of battery cells annually based on the production rate? I mean, we don't know. So it's not like Tesla's been cut red-handed on anything like that. And right after that, he ended up removing his account. So a bunch of speculation why he did.
I think Twitter actually removed his account or gave him a timeout, and then he removed it afterwards, or Twitter removed it afterwards or something.
That's not what his lawyer said. So his lawyer released a statement later saying that it was completely on his own. He didn't really give much of a reason, but other than he decided on his own to remove that. He said that his LinkedIn and Facebook were hacked earlier this week, so maybe he was afraid for his Twitter. I don't know. He deleted it himself. That's what we know.
Sounds strange.
Yeah, he didn't do it before, like, creating a real shitstorm, really, because that the information I released, that was gold for the shorts, of course. But right. we tried to share it as without any bias as possible. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's really a he said situation. Like you have to trust him on that information, because there's nothing clear that shows that those vehicles are indeed potentially dangerous if they have punctured cells. But again, I have a lot of difficulty trusting this guy based on his general behavior.
Yeah, yeah, I wonder where it's even coming from. I mean, I guess there's probably some gray area in terms of punctured. Maybe, you know, a cell was, you know, damaged in some way, but Tesla felt that damage wasn't enough to affect its, you know, ability to provide a charge and be charged. So, I mean, there is some gray area, some ambiguity that could exist where he could be sort of right and Tesla could be sort of right. But, you know, we'll probably never know.
Yeah, that's probably closer to the truth, right? Because if it's actually punctured, a lithium ion cell punctured, I think it explodes or it catches on fire pretty right. fast. It's definitely not punctured. If there's anything, it's probably, like you said, in the middle. There was a little bit of damage on those cells, but they were able to repair it and make it acceptable to be inside of a production battery module. I don't know.
Yeah. So that's that.
Yeah, that's that. And then something crazier happened. another self-proclaimed whistleblower came out, and I mean, take everything he said with a grain of salt, because all that information only comes from this guy, and why it was printed everywhere is because he hired the same lawyer as Martin Tripp, Stuart Masoner. And this guy is a specialist at getting people settlement with the SEC, getting the whistleblower status from the SEC. And the way the SEC work with whistleblowers, if they successfully pursue a case against a company that didn't comply to their public market rules, and then they get a settlement from that company. The whistleblower, if the information helped the case, they get a percentage of it. So that's what Martin Tripp is going after for his own case, going after some SEC settlement money. And now Messner is having a second whistleblower whose name is, he released the name Carl Hansen, who's the former Tesla security employee at Gigafactory One again. So when that came out, I thought, oh, maybe we're going to get something where we have someone that corroborate Martin Tripp's information. Not entirely.
Nope. Totally new allegations.
Yeah. Crazier allegations, too. The biggest one being that, again, grain of salt, all coming from him, no other sources and anything, that Tesla, there's employees involved in the large-scale drug trafficking at Gigafactory 1. Large-scale theft of raw materials worth up to $37 million. Then he also said that after the Martin Tripp situation that happened back in May and June, Tesla ended up starting to spy on his employees at the plant, wiretapping, hacking cell phones and computers and a bunch of stuff. And ultimately, Hansen's claim, well, his claim with the SEC is that Tesla should have disclosed some of that stuff to their investors and to authorities. But on top of that, he says that when he reported that to Tesla, Tesla retaliated by firing him, basically. Now, Tesla did respond to those claims. I'm going to read you the response here to be as clear as possible. I'm quoting a Tesla spokesperson. Mr. Hansen's allegations were taken very seriously when he brought them forward. Some of his claims were outright false. Others could not be corroborated, so we suggested additional investigative steps to try and validate the information he had received secondhand from a single anonymous source. Because we wanted to be sure we got this right, we made numerous attempts to engage further with Mr. Hansen to understand more about what he was claiming and the work that he did in reaching his conclusion. He rejected each of those attempts, and to date, he has refused to speak with the company further. It seems strange that Mr. Hansen would claim that he's concerned about something happening within the company, but then refused to engage with the company to discuss the information that he believes he has. All right, so basically, they are saying that everything he said is not true or couldn't be verified at all, and that the information that he supposedly had all came secondhand from an anonymous source. So that's very weak. I mean, doesn't mean that it's not true, but it's very weak information. But then he didn't want to share much with Tesla, so that's probably what led to is firing. I don't know exactly there.
That's a good question. They didn't really say specifically why he was fired.
The reason,
So I wonder. I mean, it was already pretty long, the statement. So I guess you can't hit everything. But it just seemed kind of weird that they didn't say why he was fired.
I think there are also laws about like telling why people are being fired and everything like that. If it's not like some certain reason, you cannot disclose as why they're being fired. So maybe it's something to do with that. There's a few things you see that also that doesn't add up. He complained that Tesla failed to disclose to the DEA his claim about drug cartel being involved with in some kind of the Gigafactory, and the DEA.
I don't even know what that means. First of all, marijuana is legal in Nevada, so it's not that. Apparently, it's something worse. And drug cartels are involved in every step of those kind of other drugs. So it could be a guy selling $100 worth of whatever, Any kind of drug sale is going to involve a cartel. Like, it could be something extremely minor. It could be nothing. It could be totally made up.
Oh, yeah.
So it's all kind of BS-y to me.
Yeah, well, at large scale, though, we have to understand the way that the drug cartels operate. They do work with some companies sometimes even large companies, but not necessarily directly with large companies, but sometimes with trucking companies that do business with large companies, and then people involved at those companies at the loading docks, and a similar situation where they get things across the border. So
the implication was that Tesla was moving drugs for a cartel?
Not necessarily Tesla, but my understanding is that he's talking about Tesla being used in cartel operation, and cartel operation would normally involve like using the company's logistics system to move drugs around. I mean, other than that, there's not much you can. A drug cartel can be involved with the Gigafactory. I mean, unless it's like it's a good spot to sell the drugs, and it's definitely not. It's the middle of nowhere. I mean, though there are a lot of people that works there. But anyway, so if there's any cartel involvement, that's what comes to mind. But I mean, it's a big stretch.
Yeah.
And my point with the DEA is that the DEA commented and said that they wouldn't. Inform Tesla of information. They wouldn't reach a company involved in that. They would normally just let it go, not make themselves known in order to get more information and trace where the drug is coming from, where it's going, and stuff like that. So this it sounds like the DEA is not too worried about the situation. So investors probably shouldn't be either, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But that was added to the craziness of this week in the Tesla world. On top of the continued craziness that comes with the take private deal that Elon Musk has been pushing for over the last few weeks, what happened this week is that we got confirmation that the Saudis are involved.
Which was weird, because right before that, there was a denial of some sort, wasn't there? That the Saudis were involved?
I don't remember an exact denial of it.
Maybe I'm thinking something else.
Yeah, but what happened this week is that basically Elon justified is the way it was communicated to the public, the way that the move was communicated to the public. So we were talking about the tweet, then the blog post that came with it, which was actually an email to employees that Tesla released some blog post, whatever. We all discussed that last week. But now he explained exactly what he meant by the funding being secured at $420 per share. And that was based on a meeting he had with the executive of the Saudi Arabian Sovereign Wealth Fund. And he came out of that meeting with the impression that they were ready to invest at $420. So he had the funding ready to take the company private. So that was his logic.
The Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund is about $250 billion. It's capitalized to $250 billion. So they could actually afford to buy Tesla or some part of it, take it private.
That's what's being contested right now, because they are officially worth $250 billion
times a billion.
Yeah, on paper, but that's not liquid money. I mean, they are invested in a bunch of companies, including the own state oil company, and they also have commitment to do investment plans with other funds, including SoftBank's huge tech fund. So they are not very liquid to do the deal. But again, everything, all of it is based on Elon Musk's belief that most of Tesla's investors will retain the stock. So the take private deal will not require that much of new equity to be put in Tesla. I say not that much, but I mean, it could easily be 10, 20 billion, just not the whole value of the company itself, which would be over 71 billion. So it's not that big. He also said that the Saudis have actually been courting him to do such a deal for a while now. We learned that over the last year, they accumulated a stake worth almost 5% of Tesla. So they are definitely interested in Tesla. There's no doubt about that. Now it's whether or not they want to make that take private deal, which is a much bigger commitment than accumulating a 5% stake in the company. And just before Elon Musk reported that, we listed a bunch of media reports that were actually very conflicting about the Saudis' intention in that deal. Some were saying that they are in talk with Tesla about it. Others were saying no, they're not interested in it at all. But based on what Elon is saying, they are definitely very much interested, and they're still not commenting on themselves on the issue, which is also interesting because they couldn't themselves clarify that.
Yeah, and there's also the idea or the concern, I guess, among many that because the Saudis are so big in oil, that they just want to buy Tesla and destroy it, or take it down, or instead of diversifying. But I kind of don't believe that. I don't think something so obvious and it would just be such a PR disaster that I don't think it's realistic. But
Yeah, and the Saudis are definitely concerned about the PR lately, so right. maybe that plays into it. But there's still a lot of controversy around that deal, that's for sure. The SEC is apparently still very much concerned. This week we learned that they sent out subpoenas to Tesla about it. So the subpoena are likely about what Elon meant by funding secured. So we already know what his position here on it because of the blog post that he released about it that we just explained. So maybe I very much doubt that anything bad is going to come out of that, because I really trust what Elon said. That he said that's probably what he meant. I mean, he tweeted that, and he tweeted that based on his meeting with the Saudis. So there's probably, even if it ends up not being by the book, you have to prove also like ill intention, that he was trying to bolster the stock without actually having funding, and it really doesn't sound like that was the case. So, and also yes, they have to prove like damage, and the damage would be to the shorts, because the stock went up like a few moments after he said that, but the stock has since gotten way down, so the shorts are probably happy of the result anyway.
Yeah, it's convoluted.
Yeah, definitely. Another weird thing that happened, still involving lawsuit with Tesla. We learned that yesterday. Tesla is fighting back against the Ontario government over the weird way that they've shut down their EV incentive. So we touched that on that last month. But if you don't remember, what happened is that the Ontario government, which had one of the best EV incentive out there, up to $14,000 per all-electric vehicle, which is pretty great, and Tesla was just starting to take full advantage of it with the Model 3s, the first Model 3s in Canada. The delivery started in June, so June, July, a bunch of cars took advantage of it. And then when the new government, because there was an election in June and the Conservative Party took over, they won the election. So when they took over the government, they shut it down. But the way they shut it down, so Tesla is not contesting the fact that they shut it down, which is what a bunch of media are reporting right now, and they're reporting it wrong. Tesla doesn't like that they shut down the EV incentive. That's, of course, I mean, it promotes electric vehicle adoption. That's their mission. But they are not actually contesting the fact that they shut it down, because they're perfectly in their right to do it. What they're contesting is that the way they shut it down, they gave a phase-out period up to September 10 to every other automaker except them. And they used that stupid loophole thing that Tesla doesn't have its third-party franchise dealership. They have their own company-owned dealership. Which,
yeah, that was very weird. Because, like, why would they care, first of all, the government?
Mm-hmm.
You know, clearly they know how Tesla works. Like, they don't have dealerships. So, and I guess their idea was that they wanted to see cars on the lot. But with the Model 3, there's no cars on the lot anywhere. So,
Yeah, and that doesn't even work because it's not only for the cars on the lot, it's also for cars on order, but it's on order with dealership. That was the most interesting part about it because they said on orders with dealership. So when that language first came out, we weren't worried about it because Tesla actually has dealership license in Ontario. Even though they own the dealership, it's still they still have dealership license. So if you have an order with Tesla Canada, you have an order with the dealership. But then after we reported that, they ended up changing the language to franchise dealership. They changed the language after the fact to block out specifically Tesla.
Right, and it, and that's a huge amount of EVs as well because you have all the $35,000 reservation holders that you know probably won't see their vehicle for another, I don't know, year. So I guess they just didn't want to pay out all those $14,000 Canadian dollar payouts. That's the only rationale I can think of.
Yeah, well, they knew that Tesla would have the biggest impact on the program for sure over the next month because the deliveries were up to September 10 and they're still up. So if you want to buy a Bolt EV on the lot in Ontario, if they have them at this point, I doubt it. You still can with the $14,000. Sorry, rebate. You can own them all three, even if you had the order before July 11 when they shut down the program. Anyway, so what happened this week is that Tesla officially contested that the way that they came out with that through a lawsuit against the Ministry of Transportation. And their problem is that they're calling it basically discrimination because it's directly targeting Tesla for absolutely no good reason. But now, I mean, it's gonna be tough because the phase-out period ends September 10th, so it's only that's less than a month away. So they're asking the court to expedite the process. But I mean, if you're a reservation holder in Ontario, I wouldn't budget the rebate into
which is really
purchase.
Unfortunate because that's quite a good rebate. It's quite a good situation. I'm sure there are a lot of people in Ontario that are really pissed off, and they should be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that's such a big amount that it can make a difference. Like,
big difference.
You buy it or not. Like, with the $14, I can afford it. $14,000. Without the $14,000, I cannot afford it. Like, I'm sure there are a bunch of people in that situation.
Yep.
So that's really unfortunate. But we're going to follow the situation. But like I said, I doubt it would add up too much within the time frame of the government set. And you just talked about the $35,000 base Model 3, which of course won't be affected by that at all because there's no way you're going to get it by September 10, but it's still coming. People are going to have it. Why are we reporting on that? Because last weekend, I tweeted at Elon Musk because I was looking at the Roadster, the next-gen Tesla Roadster, and I asked Elon about the production version, how close it's going to be to the concept that we saw, and he responded that it's that the production design is going to be even better, especially in details, he said. But why we're talking about the Model 3 is that he said that the primary focus right now, it's not, so we couldn't elaborate on the Roadster. The primary focus remained on making the affordable version of the Model 3, and then bringing Model Y to market, which is another thing. But the affordable version of Model 3 is still coming. And I sort of comboed that in an article because I remember something that he said during the conference call for the earnings earlier this month that we didn't cover. Really, it sort of went under the radar, but I think it was a very important comment. And it works with the base version of Model 3, is that Musk revealed that Tesla came up with a new design for battery modules, so a new battery module design that's going to be, I quote, lighter, better, and cheaper.
So I like that.
Yeah.
Lighter is going to make a big difference because I think it'll push it over the efficiency rating of the Hyundai Ioniq, making it the most efficient EV on the market, which, you know, that doesn't make a big difference to a lot of people, but it's another feather in the hat, especially since the Ioniq is a very Prius-y cheap car with very small wheels, and the Model 3 is kind of a sports sedan with people, everybody loves the Model 3 that drives it. So I don't think everybody who drives the Ioniq is very excited about the situation, unfortunately,
yeah,
because it's a nice car.
Yeah, it's still like the efficiency king, which is cool on its own. But yeah, there's a chance that that module with the smaller 50 kilowatt hour battery pack could beat it. Not impossible. But so the timing of it, you said that the pack is coming, is going to be ready around the end of the year, and it's going to hit volume production in Q1, which would sort of match Tesla's timeline for the release of the base Model 3. So in my view, though it's not confirmed, the timing and what Elon said and everything, it sounds like this new battery module is going to enable the $35,000 Model 3, the base version of Model 3, which is going to be cheaper, but could be still profitable for Tesla.
Now, so that battery module is going to be two-thirds the size by power of the current 310-mile version. Is it possible that it's actually small enough that you could actually add some extra space in the base Model 3, in the $35,000 Model 3? I mean, maybe you get more leg room.
No, not with the... because you're just talking about a new design for the battery modules, mm-hmm. and not the battery pack architectures. And based on what we know about the battery pack architecture, it's the architecture doesn't change between the base version of the battery pack and the long-range battery pack. And they have the same four modules. They just have fewer battery cells per modules. So gotcha. The battery pack itself wouldn't change in size and in dimension. So,
but it will weigh less.
Yeah. So that's the big thing. It would be lighter, and not just lighter because it would have fewer cells. It sounds like it's going to have a whole new battery module design, which is going to be itself lighter. So lighter with fewer cells, lighter with a new module design. Now we're starting to talk about something very efficient here, which is going to be very exciting. So it's something to look forward to if you're waiting for that base version of the Model 3. It's something to get excited about, I think, because right now there's a bunch of things to get excited about the Model 3 on the experience of owning it. You said like everybody who drives it loves it. And you have the new performance version of the Model 3, which is great on its own. So it's a bunch of very exciting things, but the Model 3 is still expensive under those configuration. Now, at $35,000, it would be much less expensive. And also, it could be like an efficiency machine, which are going to be able to be cheaper to charge to, because you're going to get more distance or on the same energy capacity, which is awesome too. So cheaper to charge, more efficient. We love it. What else about the Model 3 this week? Yeah, still on the base version. What came out today was a UBS note. So there was a bunch of questions.
UBS.
Yeah,
we know their lawyers well.
Yeah, we're best friend with UBS. I'll check. So what happened is that apparently they got their hands on a long range version of the Model 3 to do a teardown of it. So we heard about a bunch of teardown recently of Model 3s over the last few months. But UBS came out with completely different result based on their cost analysis of that teardown. They said that Tesla would lose about $6,000 on that base version at $35,000. That the break even price would be around $41,000 with option, or closer to $42,000 would make about $600 on it, or close to that. So, an unprofitable vehicle, money-losing vehicle, up to about $42,000. And they came out with the battery cost at $178 per kilowatt hours, which is also a bit high, much higher than we think.
Tesla's even noted that it's heading towards $100 per kilowatt hour.
At the cell level.
At the cell level. Yeah. And then they have a new pack design coming.
The UBS didn't clarify that, but I have to assume that that's at the pack level that they're talking about.
Right. It's still a high amount.
Yeah. It's still definitely high. So we posted that this morning, but then in the electric stake, we sort of broke it down a little bit because it's there's a few things that are weird about it. First of all, like we already said, it completely different result from other teardown. We talked about the Monroe Research teardown. We had those guys had to do a mea culpa because they said the same thing at first. Then once doing the false cost analysis, they said that, ooh, actually it's going to be very a highly profitable car. Then there was a German teardown before that, a few months before that. Those guys came out with a cost of materials plus production cost of around $28,000. So that's and then Elon Musk said that he actually agreed with that report, that he sees the base Model 3 cost achieving $28,000 once they reach full production capacity. So it's a situation. Do you trust UBS cost analysis or you trust those guys' cost analysis?
And here's something even more interesting. If you go into the comments of the story, there's an article in Institutional Investor covering the UBS Evidence Lab, which hires Monroe Associates for their Bolt cost analysis. So they actually use Monroe Associates data in their analysis. So how is Monroe saying that Tesla can make a bunch of money on Model 3, and UBS, which uses Monroe, is saying that they're going to lose a bunch of money? And so I think this is they kind of fudge their own data to kind of back up their long-term thesis.
Yeah.
Which is trying to covering their outlook.
Yeah, that was my point too, because if we look last year, they came out with another cost analysis of the Model 3 before it was even out. And they based that cost analysis on their teardown of the Chevy Bolt EV, which makes no sense to me at all, because how can you compare the Model 3 to Chevy Bolt EV, two completely different vehicle program? One is being mostly made by LG in Korea. It's much lower volume than the Model 3 is. So completely different.
Different size packs.
Different size pack, different, completely different interior, much simpler interior for the Model 3. So a bunch of very variables that doesn't make sense to try to compare it. But the interesting thing is that they came out with almost the same price too, like that $41,000 break-even price almost. So to me, it sounds like confirmation bias, where they knew where they wanted to end up with the real cost analysis, and so they steered the numbers toward that. That's what I think. And the other thing that we mentioned too is that when we did that first report on their cost analysis of the Model 3 based on the Chevy Bolt EV, which we sort of laughed at, UBS sent us a ton of messages trying to take down that article, saying that we were using their material illegally, even though that's a bunch of materials that they sent to media and it was reprinted everywhere. But in our article, which of course was critical of it, they didn't want us to use any of their not only their images, but not even like taking a few phrases from the report, which is fair use. So they were very weird about it. They really wanted us to take it down, which at the end we didn't want to deal with them anymore. So we didn't take down the article, but we ended up gutting all the stuff that they wanted out because we just couldn't deal with them anymore. So that's factoring into our opinion of UBS here. So that report had a lot of weight today, contributed a lot. Tesla, I think, going down today, but I think it's nonsense if you ask me.
Yeah, I agree. It's hard to trust UBS in this case.
Yeah, tough to get behind them. Another teardown of the Model 3s were probably going to be coming soon from Sweden, from Volvo.
Yeah.
A reader sent us a picture of a Model 3 being spotted in Sweden, way ahead of a launch in Sweden for sure. I mean, a launch in Europe is not coming for months again, so that was surprising to see a vehicle there. But then you look at the license plate and you do a reverse license plate check with the Sweden Ministry of Transport, and it shows that it's actually registered to Volvo. So Volvo is probably doing some tests with the Model 3s, trying to learn its secrets and probably eventually even do a reverse engineering, a benchmark and reverse engineering of the car, if you ask me. And that's very interesting because Volvo is coming up with their first all-electric vehicle. They said earlier this year that they had the XC40, which have been like a very well-received car, got a ton of great reviews. For the gas-powered version, and now they're going to come up with an all-electric version of it, which should be pretty exciting. And if they are learning from the Model 3, from the powertrain of the Model 3, then maybe it's not going to be too bad.
Yeah, and they also have the Polestar subsidiary, which are kind of making EVs, although I think they're kind of hedging a little bit there. I was going to make some sort of joke about how Volvo has a new EV coming out, and it's actually a Tesla Model 3, but it didn't work out. This is typical, right? Like every car company gets every other company's car. They reverse engineer them.
Yeah, I wouldn't say every other. A bunch of people tells me that, but there's so many cars coming out. You don't need to check them all. You check those that are pique your interest, and you think, oh, there could be some innovations in there that we could learn from. And the Model 3 is definitely one of them. That a lot of people are interested in. We've seen it from Ford. We've seen it from a bunch of German automakers. Not clear how many now. Volvo. So it's definitely getting around for sure.
Yeah.
And there was another note from an analyst this week, a little bit more upbeat than the UBS note about the Model 3s. The guys from Evercore, from London, they came down to Fremont to check out the factory for a few days. Apparently, they got a very thorough tour of the factory, which Tesla does sometimes from investor and from analyst firms. And they came out very impressed. They said that they see Tesla ramping up as planned from 5,000 to 6,000 units in the coming weeks. Which Tesla said was coming. They said that they aimed for to be ready by the end of the month, really. So that's interesting. Then he went further than that. The Hypercar guys went further than that and said that they see a clear path to 8,000 units per week with very little capital expenditure. So that's something that Tesla said earlier this month, that they were really coming down on the capital expenditure to increase production. Because they're going to do it on the existing lines instead of bringing up new lines. So that's pretty exciting. And Evercore see it happening. So that's sort of a third-party verification of what Tesla said earlier this month. So you don't just have to believe Tesla. It looks like it's happening.
Yeah.
Moving on from Tesla,
like,
though it does.
That's not unbelievable. Like, they're... Sorry, I talked over you there. I'm a little bit late. But it's not unbelievable that Tesla can go from 5,000 to 6,000 to 8,000 over the coming months. That's just how efficiencies work, right? Like,
yeah.
Everybody seems to think that this is some sort of miracle that they're even at 5,000. But like,
well, it was tough to get to 5,000, that's for sure. So if you based on historic data from Tesla, you'd think that moving from 5,000 to 10,000 is going to be very rough too. But they learned a lot from that first part of the ramp up, so the second part should be a lot easier and a lot slower too. I mean, they went from like they weren't at 1,000 unit like in December. They weren't even they were barely at 1,000 in December last year. They got up to 5,000 in the space of 6 months or less than 6 months, and now the new ramp up, they're saying like to the next 5,000, it's not going to be until sometime next year. So they're being more vague, they're taking more of their time, and instead they're focusing on getting there cheaper with less capital to invest in those lines while trying to maintain the quality of the car. So I think that's a cool strategy.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, but moving on from Tesla, but still. It will have an interest to Tesla owners for sure, especially if you live in condominiums. Because, as you may know, it can be a nightmare to install charging solutions, electric vehicle charging solution at condos because, for a bunch of reasons, for an actual hardware limitation reason, because your meter, your electrical panel per condo can be limited to, normally the standard is 100 amps. So you're limited to 100 amps. So having a 30, 40 amps charger on that panel can be a challenge. Also, especially in the bigger condo complex, if you have like dozens or even hundreds of co-owners, you often have to, depending on the policy of the board, you often have to get board. You have to get the board authorization to deploy a charging solution if it's going to affect the other owner. So, for example, if you have an interior garage, you have to get some hardware through common areas, then you're going to have to talk to the board about it. They're going to have to approve it. It can be a real nightmare. We've heard some horror stories about about people taking like months, even years to get approval from the board before even having to start the process of getting an installation done. A lot of trouble. So what we did last week is that we went and checked out the company right here in Quebec. They were based in Laval, which is just north of Montreal. And those guys have a very interesting stories because they are the company sort of spin-off of Lilco Electric. And Lilco Electric is the preferred installer of Tesla charging station in Quebec, both for owners, like for homeowners that buy a Tesla, they often go to Lilco, especially in the greater Montreal region. But they're also Tesla's partner for the destination charger program. So Tesla deploys station through its destination charger program with restaurants and hotels and other companies. And when they do that, they deal with Lilco that installs the Tesla wall connectors for the destination charger, and also the general G1772 station for universal station for other electric vehicle that Tesla often installs with those. So they know a lot about installing charging stations. And what happened is that they had to deal with the situation of someone wanting to buy an electric vehicle, often a Tesla, and living in a condominium. And they were having issues trying to install those chargers because of the previously mentioned problems with it. So they decided to develop a custom solution. And so David Corbeil, who's the son of the two owners of Lilco, started his own company under sort of as a subsidiary of the company, if you will, called RVE. And that company developed a demand charge controller specifically for people that want a charging station in the condominium. What it does is that you install it between the meter of a condo, which is normally in the electrical room of the condo where you have all the meter. We went and checked out one of their installation with a condo complex with, I think it was 120 condos, I think.
And those meters are usually in the garage.
Yeah, in an electrical room next to the garage. So it's still close to where you would park your car. But then, so they're all there. But the electrical panel is actually inside those condos. So you have the meter all in the same rooms, then all the electrical panel in each individual condo. You install that device, the DCC, the main control charge, the general charge controller, which is a small box, boring little box that maybe like 8x8, something like that. 8-inch by 8-inch, and they installed that there in the electrical room, linked it to the instead of the meter going directly to the electrical panel, they cut that power, then they put it inside the demand charge, then up from the demand charge to the panel. So what it does is that it detects the electricity coming from the electricity consumption going to the panel, and split that goes to the charger, the actual charger. So then you go to whatever the spot is from that DCC to your charging station. It can be just a NEMA 1450 plug, or it can be an actual Tesla wall connector or any other charging station. It's completely charging station agnostic. So what it does is that it's going to detect the consumption of the panel, and if the consumption is over 80%, it's going to shut down the access of the power to the charging to the charge station. So that way, even if you have just 100 amps panel, you can still get a 30, 40 amps charging station, and you don't have to worry about losing power because the DCC is going to always make sure that the electrical panel gets a priority, and the car is only going to charge when there's enough capacity to do it.
Right. So, like, for instance, if you're using your dishwasher, your oven, and you're drying clothes in the dryer all at once, that can pull a huge load. And what it'll do is turn off your electric vehicle charging while all three of those things are happening. Usually that's a pretty brief period of time, but at least it won't hit the main breaker and you won't have to go downstairs and reset your power.
Yeah, exactly. There's only a few situations where that will happen. Like you said, dishwasher, your washing machine, all those very energy heavy stuff. And so basically at night, for example, there's always going to be any problem. You're going to be able to charge your vehicle at night at full capacity without any issue. Just when those things, you don't have to worry about whether to switch it or not. So that's basically was the biggest issue with hardware issue with installing a charging station at a condo. But the other advantage that it offers too is that it only involves your own electrical infrastructure for the condo and not any other architecture, electrical architecture for like the common space or anything, because it goes from your own meter that you own to the DCC that you now own and into your electrical panel. So everything is being added to your own system instead of the rest of the condo.
Is there any intelligence in these things? Like if you're in a time of use type of situation where, you know, electricity costs more at a certain period of the day, it'll just shift the charging to the night, you know, the low period, the low cost periods? Or is this just specifically just for this purpose?
Yeah, it's specifically for the purpose. The only other thing that they discussed too is that because right now it's not modulating the power. So even if, for example, you're not at fully 80%, but you could still have some power left for the station instead of using the whole 30 amps, you could just modulate the power to the station. They said that they could do, but they haven't really activated that feature yet because they want to remain for now really completely charger agnostic. And to do that, you also need the charger to be able to modulate the capacity. And not every charger can. Some can, like Tesla's can, and a bunch of other can, I think. But they don't want to do that just yet to remain charger agnostic. As for the time of use thing, not that I know of. I don't think so.
So that's a good segue to the Tesla expanding infrastructure in New York with urban supercharger stations. I actually saw one of these. It wasn't in New York City, up a little bit, and we used them to charge our Model 3. These are pretty cool. I'm wondering if we're going to start seeing the private sale of these things. You think Tesla will ever do that?
Specifically the urban supercharger? Because they already sell the supercharger, like the normal looking
one. The fleets
one.
And stuff.
Yeah, right. For fleet. Actually, when I was at Lilco, I saw a bunch that were there because they also the one that installed the supercharger for Tesla when they were for private use. So someone in Montreal is getting a private supercharger. You could certainly do the same thing with the urban one, which is like at 72 kilowatts. So it's similar to the private regular supercharger, which is like at 60 kilowatts. So it's not the full 120 like the regular ones. The news basically was that Tesla is expanding their urban supercharger station in New York City, which makes a lot of sense because New York City is very much a urban area, where you have the same, Tesla is trying to fix the same issue that we were talking about, RVE, trying to make it so that people that are apartment dwellers that don't necessarily have the perfect parking situation, they are able to still get charging. So you go to that supercharger station for an hour or two, you get your full charge, then you're good for a few days or a full week even easily. And there's, if you look at the actual map now between the new urban superchargers and all those Tesla destination charger in New York, the city is just completely covered with charger. In Manhattan itself, like not the other boroughs, but New York City itself is very well covered right now. Bunch of garages where you have like valet service and everything, where they also have a few spots now with the destination charger. So if you are coming to New York from somewhere else and using supercharger station along the way with up to 120 kilowatts, then you arrive at New York itself. You don't necessarily need 100 kilowatts because you can leave your car in those garage for a full day or whatnot to do whatever you want to do in New York and not use your car there because it's not ideal. You leave your car in one of those garage. Then when you come back to pick it up, it's full charge, and then you can get back to your way and use the supercharger on your way back.
Yeah, and this is great for people, like we were saying before, that live in a huge building that maybe doesn't have access to the product we were talking about just now. Mm. You know, you don't have a home charger, but you can go once a week to, you know, one of these like tons of destination or urban superchargers, and you basically fill up in, you know, an hour or so. So yeah. It's good for people who don't necessarily have, it's good for commuters who come in, but it's also good for people who don't, you know, that typically have street parking. Like if you live in a brownstone in New York, you're not going to be able to charge on the street. So any of these, like, it looks like hundreds of destination or urban superchargers are going to be fantastic for getting a charge once a week, just like you would a gas car.
Yeah, it's going to make a big difference. And still on the Tesla Supercharger network, we posted today that Bollinger, if you remember Bollinger, they are a New York based startup
Hobart, right?
I don't remember the exact location, but they are upstate, if you can call it that. I don't know how up it is upstate, but it's not New York City, and they are developing what they are calling a all electric utility truck, so it's more like a Jeep type vehicle, but a little bit bigger, look very robust, simple lines and everything, but it's a all electric powertrain, all-wheel drive system. Looks like a very cool product. We've been reporting about it for maybe the past 2 years now, I think, well, at least a year for sure. And now they're getting closer and closer to production. And they reach out to Tesla, to Elon Musk, really, on Twitter, asking for them to use the charging network, the Tesla's charging network. Which is, of course, something that Tesla has been talking about for a while, to open up the supercharger network to other automakers. Last year, J.B. Straubel even said that they are actively talking to other car makers about opening up the supercharger network to them, but it hasn't materialized into anything yet, which is kind of weird. Kind of weird and kind of not weird at the same time, because you still don't have any cars that can take the Tesla's charge rate up to 120 kilowatts. Other than the vehicles that are coming very soon to market now. So those cars, like the Audi e-tron and so forth, are going to be able to take it. So maybe there's going to be some kind of surprise announcement then.
I don't think so.
Me neither. but so far, there's nothing that's been confirmed yet. So officially, no one has been part of the Supercharger network outside of Tesla. But now we have one automaker, or at least like an automaker startup, that clearly show their interest to be part of the Supercharger network, which I think would be very cool, because especially for Bollinger, so I think it's a win-win situation for Tesla and Bollinger, but for Bollinger it's going to be a big plus, because it's a big advantage to get to your buyers. I mean, if you're going to buy the Bollinger truck and you know that you have access to the Supercharger network, even if you're going to have to pay for it most likely, it's still great. I mean, it's by far the best fast charging network out there, so to have access to that, it's a game changer.
And yeah, and it makes it easier for Bollinger. They don't have to think about that kind of, you know, infrastructure.
Yeah, well, they could always do like anybody else and just work with third party network and have basically you let your customer deal with it and deal with those charge point and those EVgo and whatnot. But it's, of course, much easier to just deal with Tesla, even if you have to pay for it. And that's the thing for on Tesla's side, the deal, at least there's never been a deal yet, but every time that Tesla executive talked about a deal like that, they said that all they would require from the automaker is to contribute to the cost of the supercharging station based on the usage of your fleet on that network. So, of course, for Bollinger, it would be fairly limited at first, at least. I mean, we're not talking about a huge volume, but it would make a big difference, I think. And the money that it would contribute on the network for the electricity use and the maintenance and everything, Tesla could use that to expand the network. So I really think it's a win-win situation. I think
it should happen. Yeah, it would be good for Tesla to actually test it out with a small automaker, just, you know, to see how it works, see how the use affects the network, see, you know, how good a third party can be.
Yeah, it's a low risk. It's a low risk thing for Tesla, and it would sort of act as a framework for future agreement. That's what you're saying, I think.
Right. And then, you know, Tesla could say, hey, look, you know, Bollinger can do it. Why can't Toyota, for instance? Because Toyota, you know, could easily join something like that.
Yeah. And then real quick before we go, because I know Seth needs to go right now. The Boring Company announced this week that they have a new project, the Dugout Loop. They changed their first project, their first official full network system, loop system in Los Angeles, which was supposed to be a project in West Los Angeles. That's probably still going to happen, but it's not going to be the first full loop in Los Angeles. It's going to be one between that's going to be running like in parallel to the 101 from what's it called? Close to the Vermont Sunset Station in Los Feliz.
You're more familiar
with the Los Angeles region, so go ahead.
Yeah, it's just going. Dodger Stadium is just north of downtown, so it would basically go along the 101, which is kind of like the north of LA to the north of downtown LA into Hollywood, and then, you know, it goes over to the valley. So this would allow people in, you know, the Sunset area, you know, Vermont, I guess, is the cross street there, to get to Dodger Stadium in 4 minutes, which sounds fantastic.
Yeah. That's a 3.6 mile tunnel. So they're planning on doing the 3.6 mile tunnel in that region to get to the Dodger Stadium in, like you said, 4 minutes. So very cool project. Moving forward with it, and they want that to be the new proof of concept with the full system, with the lifts to get inside the car, the electric skates that they're developing, and to get in and out of the stations, and then inside that tunnels up to the stadium and back. So that's going to be the new main project in Los Angeles to show the proof of concept, which of course they aim to eventually expand into a whole network of tunnels under Los Angeles to fix the traffic issue. And what's most exciting is that's all electric. So it should technically affect emissions.
Yeah, there's a very humorous Curb Your Enthusiasm where he gets a prostitute so he can go in the carpool lane to get to Dodger Stadium on time. And this is the exact scenario where this would be helpful.
Useful, yes, for sure.
You know, you won't need to get a prostitute to get in the carpool lane.
Well, if you have a Tesla, you're okay. If you have an electric car, you're okay. Right. You should be able to use it, which is cool too. But yeah, I mean, and we're very excited about the Boring Company here. Of course, we had our tour last month there. Unfortunately, we weren't allowed to share anything about it, but it's a very exciting company. They're doing cool stuff. They're really pushing forward the way to basically bore tunnels, which is where the name of the company comes from. So a lot of cool stuff coming up. A lot of cool stuff at Electrek coming up soon, too. We're going to have some announcement in the coming weeks or months about the new stuff at Electrek, so stay tuned on that. We're going to try to upgrade also the podcast a little bit, make it more professional a little bit, because we are surprised by how many of you guys are listening, which is always cool. So thanks a lot for listening. Thanks a lot for watching on YouTube. And please subscribe on your podcast apps and on YouTube too. We always appreciate that. And we're going to see you same time next week. Thanks a lot.